Okay, I think it's going to work now. It might be the tape was stretched or something, too. This happened in New York, same thing on it.
You want some more coffee?
Well, I have a slightly prejudiced point of view with respect to special interest groups, and I should share that. There are other people who would say this convention did a wonderful job about things, but among the things that I think, and this, discount this by whatever you want to, but I think the purity of heart, or whatever you might want to call it, of the delegate body in comparison with 1970 and 1981, there were more people who were less focused on specific economic issues in 1970 and were more interested in doing what they thought was participating in a historical event, the first time in 100 years, and that we had rewritten the document. In 1980, the idea of a convention was not absolutely new. In 1970, the traditional lobby groups did not know how to work with us, because fundamentally we weren't lobbyist material. We didn't have any political ambitions. Now, that's not to say that there were not some people who emerged from that convention who later held significant political office. For example, a couple of the people, and I didn't even know they were interested in it, and they ran for attorney general and became the state's attorney general, later served in Congress, and ran unsuccessfully 2 years ago for the Senate. But for the most part, they were professional people, probably too many lawyers, which is always a hazard. Lawyers have extremely different viewpoints. There's no uniformity of viewpoint among lawyers because they traditionally represent different economic interests and different ideas about things, and they just simply like to disagree. So that's, if you were going to limit anybody, besides limiting legislators, you might want to limit lawyers. But from the federal constitutional standpoint, you probably couldn't do that. We simply didn't have as many axes to grind in 1970. In 1980, as I've indicated, the tax decision by the Arkansas Supreme Court, other concerns of that sort, minority groups were better organized, better focused, and indeed we had better minority representation, and by that primarily I mean blacks, in the 80 convention than we had in 1970. One of the delegates, black college professor, served in both conventions. But the political forces and the political ladder climbers saw the convention as a way to get involved in government, the people who wanted to run for other office. That created some problems with the legislature because they saw people running for delegate positions and they then thought they would see 2 years later running against them for their particular seats. Somebody will have to do a scientific study and sort out the special interest groups. I don't have names or numbers with respect to that, except that it was clear that there were people who were more susceptible both to the efforts of lobbyists, were more representative of narrower segments of the community in terms of economic interest, employee groups, other positions. And as a consequence, their discussions tended to be more focused along those lines than our discussions in 70, which I thought were perhaps not approaching the Constitutional Convention of 1787 or whatever, but at least dealing more fundamentally with the philosophy of the structure. No, I'm not saying necessarily that's wrong, but I think it is something that you should be aware of, that in a situation where you know there is going to be a convention and where there are particular interests which have been identified as being affected by the Constitution or likely to be affected by the Constitution, it's not unreasonable to expect that there will be an effort to load up the delegate body with people from one point of view or another on those questions. Sam's experience in Illinois is probably better with regard to that, or some state which is which has better organizations, let's say, stronger organizations, especially in schools. Labor never has been a force which could elect very many delegates. Labor had better representation in 1970 than they had in 1980. Indeed, between 1970 and 1980, labor had attempted to repeal the right to work provision in the Arkansas Constitution, and it had failed by a vote of 3-4-1. So the 1980 delegates didn't give labor the time of day. And the people had spoken recently on that issue, and therefore they didn't see any reason to waste their time on the end of that. The banks were much more evident in this group. Strong lobby effort on trying to deal with the 10% limitation. And indeed, that was one of the forces that that caused a great difficulty with the document and the submission of the document, because it was identified by many groups as being a pro-bankers constitution to raise the interest rates and require the poor man to pay more. Now, with respect to the technical organization of the 80 convention, as I say, they built on and used for the most part the same structure that was used in 1970. They didn't attract quite as strong a staff because it wasn't as new and it wasn't as different. And it was somewhat more politicized, and some of the people that I thought were really first-rate staffers that we had in 70, you know, it was 10 years later and they had other career interests and other things. There was some better support on the legal side, because some of the things that were coming before the convention had been in the courts, the property structure. And the Attorney General had been trying to wrestle with that. The Governor's Office had been trying to wrestle with it. Some other groups had. We had done not extraordinarily good staff work in terms of papers. I mean, we didn't publish anything like the 9-foot shelf of materials at the New York did or anything like that. And we didn't spend $10 million doing it. Most of the background work had been preserved from our 1970 work, and some of that is available. We were, because the university now has a law school in Little Rock, we were able to call on some faculty people in the law school at UALR to work with the committees, which was something we didn't have in 1970. The school had developed. Really, I guess that's kind of the end of the monologue in terms of trying to cover the ground of what has happened in about over 14 years. And, you know, if we can talk about some more specific things, let's do that.
Okay, one of the questions that I wanted to ask, some of the states have done it and some haven't. And in both of your cases, did the Preparatory Commission work on temporary rules for the Constitution or for the convention prior to the convention meeting?
Well, I think yes, yes, we did in both cases.
Both Arkansas cases.
Yeah, in both Arkansas cases, the study commission did develop. Well, I've forgotten one job I had, and I guess I'll tell you. In 1967, after we made our report to the legislature, to a special session of the legislature which convened in 68, and that's the one that called for the submission of the question. Assuming that there was to be a favorable vote between the submission of our work product in March of 1968 and the placing of the issue on the general election ballot to be voted on in November of 1968, we had a little surplus left over in our appropriation for the study commission. The governor created a preparatory commission composed of myself and two other people. And the two people who'd been the chairman and the vice chairman of the study commission. And I was chairman. I'd forgotten that we had that little interim preparatory commission for about 6 or 7 months in 1968. And what we did, largely the I carried over my principal research person, Walter Noon, Sam, we carried over the principal staff person that we had on a modest salary because we really wanted him to be available to head the research staff if there was a convention in 1968. And his primary task was to assemble a proposed set of rules for the convention, both the temporary and permanent rules. And I'm trying to remember, I'm not sure where we borrowed those rules. We kind of patched together a set of rules from New York, some from Michigan. I can't remember where Illinois was at that point in time. Maryland was a very good model for us in many respects. And indeed, now that I think about it, we may have borrowed more from Maryland than almost any place else in terms of structure. Some of our drafting techniques we borrowed both from Alaska and from Hawaii, because those have been the two most recently drafted new constitutions. And when we were looking for fundamental structures of things, how to really simplify things that didn't have a whole lot of history built into them, we looked at some of those. But now that I remember it, Maryland had a was running just about a year ahead of us in terms of the total timetable. And Maryland did not have that much different history than Arkansas had in terms of the age of its document. And while it's considerably more urban, it also had the rural influences and things like what do you do with justices of the peace, you know, after you no longer need anybody to provide the judicial structure of a township. You know, when the township has ceased to be, in our case, it never was a significant form of government, it certainly ceased to be a form of government. So we found a number of parallels in Maryland. But yes, we did have a small, in fact, one-man staff preparatory commission drawing rules for us. Now, when we came to the 80 convention, the other preparatory commission, we had all of the 1970 stuff there. And it was a question of looking at it again and saying, well, you know, that didn't work quite right. Or I guess our biggest concern in the new preparatory commission was not wanting to appear to be telling the 1980 group that, well, here's the way we did it in 1970 and that was perfect. That's the way you ought to do it now. We wanted, at all costs, to avoid saying, well, fellas, here's the way we did it, and this is the way you ought to do it. We probably were less effective in a couple of cases because we were always saying, well, you do whatever you want to do, and, you know, by the way, here's what you did in 1970. It worked out well in transition. They changed a few things in the rules, but on the whole, they didn't change very much. We were not dictatorial. We were not saying there's only one way to do it. I think we had a good transition in that respect, and the fact that most of us have been in the 70th convention was, you know, no particular impediment to them. I testified a number of times before the Finance and Taxation Committee and the Judicial Committee. Tried to help some of their people in drafting. I know other people who were in the 70th convention also made comments and appeared before some of the committees, particularly early in the work of the 80 convention, in order to describe the problem as it was perceived in 1970, in order to explain the drafting that we had done in 1970, and to say, you know, in retrospect, I wouldn't do it that way now, or that's not, you know, you don't have the same problem that we had. It was an effort to try to work with them. And as a result of it, I haven't done any scientific comparison, but I'd say 85 or 90% of the 1980 document was, all of it was structurally the same as the 1970 document. That is the way the articles were laid out, the way the transitional provisions were put together. Now, and 90% of it was almost verbatim. I mean, there were a few words that seemed to have been changed only because somebody thought, well, we ought not to you know, we ought not to have exactly the same words. We ought to have a few words of our own. Or, you know, in the drafting process, somebody said, well, I don't know why they said it that way. Let's do it. Now, that doesn't prove anything except that the second convention had the benefit of part of the hard work that the public never sees, and that is somebody's got to put something down on paper and work with it. And as long as you can have a transitional group or a preparatory group that does not appear to be, and indeed is not, some sort of hidden agenda from the legislature or the governor or some other group, as long as you have a group which is and is perceived to be an aid and simply getting material together and giving people at least one way or perhaps alternative ways to look at solutions. Delegates will receive that material well, and indeed when they get there in the first few days, if someone hasn't done that work, they're going to be mad as hell. They're going to say, you know, what do you mean? You get all of us down here, I'm away from home, I'm not being paid enough to be here. And you hand me a book that says it's the Constitution of 1874 and you don't tell me anything. One other comparison I would make between the 70 group and the 80 group, and again it relates to lawyers and the kind of people who ran. The 80 group was probably a less informed, or that is less well-educated group on the whole, with respect to both political issues and certainly with respect to constitutional issues. This sounds unfair. I don't mean for it to say that, sound that way. But in 70, we had, superior group of representatives of lawyers. That is, people who were mature and established in the profession, and people who were not special interest oriented as such in terms of the lawyers as a group. In terms of the laypersons who were there, they were clearly more of the community leader type, whether they were bankers or retailers or whatever they might have to be. This is true both of men and women. In the 1980 convention, I would say that we had probably a somewhat younger group of people, less well established in the traditional terms of leadership in business or profession. I don't mean to say that they were any less intelligent, but they were not perceived to be of quite the same status of community leadership in their various communities. And as far as the lawyers group was concerned, we did not have as many people who were from the so-called established firms or were from elements of leadership in the bar association structure and so forth. Now, I don't know whether that was purely just coincidental, whether it was that it was not a crusade and you didn't get some busy bank executive to agree to run in 1980 because it was seen to be more of a political job and less of an event than it was in 1970. I didn't run simply because I was, number one, I thought I'd done all I could do, and I didn't feel that going out there and going through it again was worth the effort, personally. I mean, everything that I had as a solution to the problems was already written down in either one of two documents. Secondly, my own professional work, the maturity and level of responsibility that I had in my firm, and the opportunity to make money was greater to me than in 1980. Was 1970. I simply wasn't able to make that move. I do not regret it now. I enjoyed the days that I went out there to testify and, you know, stood around and told everybody how they ought to do things and that sort of stuff. But I didn't miss those endless hours of listening to somebody drone on and debate about something that they don't know anything about or they disagree with you on.
Sam, what about Illinois as far as rules, preparatory rules?
The commission didn't prepare rules. The commission also acted as a repository for job requests for staff in the convention. And particularly on the active accepting applications and so forth. Someone who was at the convention were furious that we were preempting their activity. We shouldn't even do that. There was someone's happiness on the rules that we were telling the convention how to operate. There is sensitivity that the convention is a free agent and they should not be, frankly, told how to do this or that. And in all of the preparatory business, you must be very careful to make suggestions, but put it in such a way that you try to be helpful, not telling them how to run the business.
If I may say there, I think, if at all possible, of course, it depends on the timing of the election and the meeting of the convention and other things like that. But if you're going to put out a lot of paperwork, even though people probably won't read it very carefully before, you know, the day before they go down or when they get there that night, it helps, I believe, to dispel the suspicion if you get that stuff out to them as long in advance beforehand as you can with, you know, the most self-effacing cover letter you can think of, that, you know, we're not trying to tell you how to do anything, but here's what you know was done before, and you can study it and change it. And that will be one of the first orders of business on the convening session will be to create a rules committee or to do something. And our temporary rules were, you know, two sheets of paper or something like that. It was pretty obvious that nobody was stacking anything in terms of the temporary. They were very, very insignificant. In our structure, the Secretary of State, who had no other position, no other function except to certify the results of the election, was the convening officer. The governor was not the convening officer. It was not politicized in that respect. And the Secretary of State just called everybody to order and made sure that the delegates had been properly certified as having been elected, sworn in. And immediately after that, they proceeded to the election of their officers, approximately in that sequence.
Just for the record, I should say our convention also used the Maryland convention pretty much as a model for rules and so forth. One of the important decisions we made in the rules was the seating of delegates shall be alphabetical. And that really made a difference in how the convention operated. If we had allowed people to be by districts, that would have meant the Chicago people sat right next to each other. It was really things which don't seem terribly important.
Sam, where was the Illinois convention held?
They convened in the House of Representatives, but then convention moved to the old State House, where Mr. Lincoln was always in presence and quoted in his House Divided speech. And it was here again, the setting set a tone. Things like this.
George, how about?
Our convention met, both conventions met almost exclusively in the House chamber of the present Capitol. On a couple of ceremonial occasions, we did meet in our old State House. We have an 1836 structure, which is fairly well preserved, although it doesn't have enough desks and seats, and I mean, it was never designed for a legislature the size of our current legislature. From the standpoint of economy, facilities, telephones, all of the housekeeping things that you need, we felt that there was only one place that we could meet. It would have been terribly expensive to rent on a long-term basis a hall somewhere. We could meet in the House chamber when the legislature was out of session. We have a 60-day limitation on our legislative session, which is, with some exceptions, it generally runs a little bit longer, but 90 days is about the longest they ever meet. So the chamber was available in late spring and summer when our convention did the real work.
In either case, were there public hearings held any other place in the state rather than at the meeting place? Either one of you, Sam?
Yes, our committees, our subcommittees, held hearings throughout the state. I don't know how important they were getting information into the mill, but they were good PR and did help some of the delegates get around and see some parts of the state. Illinois is a very sharply divided state, and a lot of Chicago people who have no feel for the rest of the state. So it was probably helpful to get them around the state and just to hear people talk with different accents. And Southern Illinois is something quite different than Chicago.
George?
I would say our differences between the various sections in the state are perhaps not as pronounced in Illinois, because even the people who live in Little Rock, some other parts of the state.
You all speak funny.
Yeah, we all speak strange. But most of us came from smaller communities in the state. So, but there is, in the smaller communities, a very definite sort of paranoia about what people in Little Rock are, how they're dominating the scene, real or unreal, mostly unreal. So both in the, and we started this in the study commission and it carried over in the 70 convention. And I believe, although I'm not as familiar with the details, I believe that the 80 convention did it as much as they could. In the study commission, we were trying to create, quite honestly, a public awareness. It was our hearings held out in the other places in the state were as much propaganda as they were interest in hearing from people. And I don't mean to say we didn't want to hear from people, but we used primarily state college facilities. Almost all of the colleges were happy, and indeed one of the members of the study commission was a college president. They were happy to have us on campus. It gave some publicity, it gave something for the students to see and hear. So, we had a state college president and we had a private, the largest private college was also, president was also a member of the state commission. So we moved around in different parts of the state, getting input from county officials, municipal officials. One of the most memorable hearings we had was down in the southern part of the state where we invited people to come and talk about game and fish problems. We have a constitutionally established Game and Fish Commission, which is almost an independent department of government. A lot of folks were out to talk about fox hunting and other things like that, which may or may not be significant in your state. It strikes me that that sort of thing is important, or extremely important in your state. But again, in a state such as yours, and indeed ours, where transportation is not all that convenient, it was important to get the delegates and the commissioners out with people and to encourage people to come. Now, we had to do a lot of pushing. That is, we had to get on the telephone and get people to come and make presentations. We made the agenda ourselves to some extent in all of these out-state sessions. We didn't have trouble getting people, but we tried to present some sort of balance. If there was somebody who was very difficult to speak very strongly for something, we tried to think of who is it that has the opposite point of view. We tried to have give an opportunity for balanced presentations if at all possible. With the convention then in 70, we, instead of taking the whole commission as we did, with 30 people you can move out and you won't quite have all 30 people there, but you can get accommodations and your budget is such, particularly if you work with colleges, you can cut your budget down. You don't have to pay for facilities and, you know, a little travel and a few meals and that sort of thing. But in the convention structure, we took the committees to different places around the state. The Finance and Taxation Committee with over four or five hearings in different corners of the state. that sort of thing. So that was helpful in terms of getting publicity in the local newspapers. It made, we tried to pick towns that had a TV station if possible, but certainly a good daily newspaper, so that there would be pictures and coverage of the testimony to make the people aware that there was something going on and that their community had had a part in what was going on, which made it look less like the word was coming down from Capitol if that was the way.
What about in both cases post-convention work as far as getting publicity out and informing the public just what you had done, that type of thing?
We published a message to the people, which, as I remember, every voter got a copy of the newspaper, which had the new constitution and explanations. There was a campaign committee, which was not publicly financed, that pushed the new constitution, and the delegates, as individuals, campaigned for the convention. In most cases, there were a few who were in opposition. We had our, as you know, we had our main constitution and four side issues, and the side issues got a lot of attention, and there was a campaign committee for merit selection of judges and against it, and there was a campaign committee for single member districts versus high two-member voting system. If you're interested, have you seen our series published by the University of Illinois Press? Because one of them just came out, so campaigning for the new constitution, tactics I used.
Is that a new one, a new publication just came out? I may not have seen that one.
Yeah, by Joanna Watson, published by the University of Illinois Press. There's another new one, a summary of the whole thing by Elmer Gertz and Joseph Shoddy, which is just out in hardback. So our activity, convention process is well done.
I would say the basic weakness in the whole process in Arkansas, both in the 70 and 80, was in the post-convention effort. Now, we went through the things that could acceptably be funded by public funds. In each case, the convention produced an address to the people, which was the text of the Constitution followed by explanatory paragraphs. But unfortunately, of course, you don't have much room in something like that to sell something. In many cases, you're restricted by simply saying, you know, this substantially incorporates the provisions of Article so-and-so of Section so-and-so of the 1874 Constitution, which most people didn't know what that said either in terms of the general public. In other cases, you're reduced to a fairly short summary of what the change is, so that it is, at best, a semi-scholarly sort of explanation capable of being understood, but not recognizing as fully that people don't, for the most part, have a recognition of constitutional issues to begin with, except for the very limited economic issues which they're concerned directly. So there was no question of anyone who was interested in getting a copy. Now, ours were distributed this way. Each newspaper in each county was provided a newsprint tabloid type copy of this document, and the publication requirement, statutory requirement, was that this be provided to each legal newspaper, that is a regularly published newspaper in the state, free of charge. And then they received something, they received a payment, but something less than the regular legal rate for publication, for inserting this document in one time in their newspaper and distributing it throughout the state. So everybody who got a newspaper which is not necessarily every household, but certainly not every voter. Everybody who got a newspaper throughout the state got a copy of this document. Plus, Secretary of State maintained a file of these, mailed them out to the courthouses and to a number of people on their public officials' mailing lists. So there was fairly wide distribution and a good deal of publicity that additional copies could be obtained from the Secretary of State and that sort of thing.
Talk about ego.
In 1970, there was no public funding available for promotion campaign. In 1980, there was some budget allowed for PR committee, and there was a PR committee of delegates composed. But its purpose was essentially to try to coordinate delegate speeches, to try to respond to requests from luncheon clubs, professional groups of one kind or another, trade associations and other things like that, just to respond to requests, and in some cases to try to generate requests for talks. But there was no money to be spent on advertising in the sense of TV commercials or newspaper ads. There was a private group formed that solicited money, bought TV time, some newspaper time. That effort was a little bit better in 80 than it was in 70, but it was not dramatic in the sense of Michigan or maybe in the sense of Illinois or so forth. There was no really big campaign. And unfortunately, a well-drafted constitution, it's pretty hard.
Have you got a little scratch pad around here?
The hardest part in a well-drafted constitution is finding somebody who's willing to give enough money to support the campaign. You know, some narrow special interest group may be willing to do it to some extent, but that's one of the hardest things there is. And somebody must have done it right. We have not done it right in Arkansas 2 times.
Well, I think probably we're going to start have to stop because of the meeting. I think the only other thing, there's other things I'd like to touch on. I don't know if we'll have a chance to get together or not. One thing I really would, if there is any possible chance to get together, I'm going to meet with the people from Texas probably tonight after the cocktail party and go through kind of the same thing. I don't know if you're available. I think you have a meeting with the committee. Just maybe some ideas of some pitfalls to avoid. I know you've explained some of them, and Sam's explained some of them too. We're trying to learn from other people's mistakes, and it's one thing that I think is pretty important about this. Although the things that you've given me this morning have really been helpful, and I've learned a lot just in this morning's session. But I really think we probably should go in that because it's supposed to start at 10:30. You might be thinking about that, and yeah, and if there's a one other possibility that Bill Casale talked about was maybe getting together on the tomorrow morning, just at breakfast rather than like this, and maybe sit around and talk, and that would give you time to gather your thoughts a little bit too, if it's possible. I just appreciate the time you two have taken now, and I know this is a busy time, but it was one way to see people that I wasn't able to see in New York and the other places.
Well, I wish we had a patented formula for success, but we learned how not to do it.
Well, there were a lot of things we did, and I think it's egotistical, but you studied our procedures and our literature. I think we did a pretty good job. We did good preparatory work. I think that was very crucial.
You certainly, as you said, Illinois is certainly well documented. I think it's probably
if the money is available anywhere, that sort of good background material is very helpful, because what happens so often is that you rush in to get a staff and you wind up picking up people who are anxious to work but they have no real depth in the area. You can't get those people who've got depth in the area overnight and they can't get the material together fast enough, and they come out with, poorly informed answers, or, I don't mean to say young people don't know anything, that's not what I'm trying to say, but you get somebody who knows the issue only from a limited sort of textbook, or just a very fragmentary sort of thing, and they don't have time to get the resources developed and really form a committee on what the substantive issues are.
Well, I think we'll finish this off since we're going to that other meeting.
Yeah.
Alanda, this is a meeting of the, in the afternoon of November 16th, 1980, and I'm with Janice Ray.
May.
May, I'm sorry. Yes. Yes. And Kathy Ray and Jim Ray, and they are all people that have had responsibilities and been involved with the Texas Constitutional Convention. Okay, I've given you all kind of a brief background of what we've done and kind of what the purpose of this meeting is and this trip has been for. I'm open to suggestions and totally informally, and don't let the tape off. Just because I like to make it informal and just a little bit of discussion of what we've talked about in the start.
Well, I was, of course, a member of the commission. And I'd like to stress the importance of having good studies and get them started even before the vote is taken. Now, you're familiar with George Braden and others, like the Citizens' Study of the Constitution. What did he call it?
The Citizens' Guide.
Citizens' Guide, right.
But more useful were the annotated versions. Of course, we have a very convoluted Constitution. We had a simplified and editorialized Constitution plus the annotation comparative analysis.
Two huge files.
And that was very, very useful. But, of course, I don't know how experienced your people will be, either the commission or the delegates. But it's good to have, I think, of different levels of information, beginning with generalization, citizen-type thing. And then progressing to the more professional and in-depth studies. But of course, we deal from the Texas experience. We just needed lots of information. That was one of our problems. We had to absorb so much so quickly on the commission. And there's a lot. I don't know how many people understand the Texas Constitution even today. That's more do now than they did, but I suppose it's just maybe three or four people because it is so involved, and yours is not, but even so, I'm sure there's some technical and intellectual brain twisters, so you need to have lots of information.
Janice, let me ask you one thing. Do you think that, this would type of information would be helpful even if they don't decide to have a constitution or convention?
It certainly would be. I do some lobbying, and of course I teach, and I use the materials all the time. And of course we did go through the experience, but then we failed. But I keep the simplified constitution, right, where I can bring it down and look at it. And I use it all the time in my teaching, and I've talked to others and who are in the legislative process. I'm sure they use it.
I'd respond to that, by saying that, of course, I second and echo what Denise said in terms of the importance of getting started early with quality research on the Constitution and constitutional issues. But in your case, particularly, it seems to me you've got a wonderful opportunity for a civic education kind of activity that whether the proposition passes for a convention or fails, and you don't have a convention, would serve to enhance and bring up the level of citizen awareness throughout your state of what is and what isn't in the Constitution. And I realize you have a newer Constitution and a shorter one and probably a much greater number of people that understand it, but I suspect may be wrong, but I suspect that the great mass of citizenship does not fully appreciate the provisions of your Constitution. If they do, it would be very different from any other state that I know of.
I'm glad you describe our population as great masses.
I think one of the most valuable tools, resource tools, that we have is the annotation, which didn't come out really in final form until after the vote had failed and everything else. That's what I refer to the most, and what I think a lot of other people, lay people, refer to the most in trying to understand it. I would think that with y'all's Constitution being newer and shorter, you could do an annotation, and also having occurred more recently, with your Constitution having been adopted more recently, you could do an annotation much more easily. You have the records of your convention and everything like that, which we didn't have. I think that would be the primary resource document that I would recommend trying to work on, but you may disagree with that.
No, I would agree with that. As I understand it, this
That's
is kind of unique. Now, you did have one in Illinois, and then the new Illinois Constitution was passed, so that the old one probably doesn't serve as much of the purpose as
very useful.
Of course, since we didn't get a new Constitution, it's proved invaluable. But I would think in connection with what we're doing here at the conference, there is a concern about citizens' attitudes toward government and the need to get citizens involved again, and a need for a community spirit or a civic sense. And this is an ideal thing. This just puts them beautifully into a civic education kind of thing, as Jim was saying. So even if it fails, it might prove its worth in getting citizens involved. I think a lot of us who did participate here in Texas were the better off for it, the citizens advisory groups and so forth. Even if the whole thing failed, I think I saw a definite change in the legislature. They were referring, I'd go to committee meetings, they referred to those propositions that failed, they wanted to at least get some of them altered in, and they were definitely influenced by their experiences, no question about that. So even if it fails, I think in terms of civic education it would be worthwhile.
Of course, the annotation would be even more valuable if the proposition fails, you know, that, that's something you could have for all time.
Certainly, because we can... We will be able to, you know, keep those on file, and that we know we're going to have a vote again in another 10 years, if that holds. Mm-hmm. It may be extended.
Probably need an amendment to make it 20 years or something.
Yeah. Top quality, careful research will pay off, I think, regardless of the vote, and be well worth every penny that you put into it. I heartily believe that from our experience. There's very little out of the research body materials that are not being picked up and used in some form or fashion.
Yeah, I think Janice made a good point, too, is the feeling that's been brought out at this conference of how important it is for the public to know what is going on. Yeah, and the citizen awareness. I think that if nothing else, that's driven home to me the need for a good citizen awareness of even the question of the Constitution and what the convention would do, could do, can't do, and shouldn't do also, and I think. But I sure have heard it echoed these last couple of days here in this meeting.
What is your committee going to do as far as education about the referendum coming up?
Well, of course, that's up to the commission. One of the things that I've proposed to them, I've been working on prior to taking this trip, is an informational brochure. And this brochure, it's in draft form now, and what we're working on is trying to have a fairly simplistic brochure that explains about what a constitution is, what a constitutional convention is, what a constitutional convention isn't, how much, you know, how important citizen participation is. And we've been thinking very seriously of basing it on the type of format that Hawaii used in the League of Women Voters in Hawaii with their semi-cartoon type brochure, where it's good enough and general enough that we're not insulting an adult by giving it to them to read, but it's also simple enough so that it can be distributed to school children.
The adults are going to be more apt to read it if you have something sort of like a cartoon.
Well,
you know, some kind of pictures or sketches somewhere.
One of my sneaky propositions is that we would be handing them out to school children throughout the whole state. And as soon as that thing appears at home, sitting on a table, somebody's going to pick it up and look at it. They will distribute it other ways too, but that's one way of getting it both to the schools and then into the home, and so that when it's sitting there, and if it's attractive enough, if it's sitting there, an adult is going to pick it up and read it. And I'm trying to make it very readable and enjoyable to read too.
Are you going to include in there information about what is in your present constitution and how relatively new it is as compared to other constitutions and things like that? I would think that would be valuable to the people in trying to decide whether they need to really take a major look at it again, because
it's a simple comparison of the Alaska Constitution as compared to those in other states, of most states.
I think so.
Texas being a bad example to compare against in terms of length and fundamental principles.
Right. The one thing we cannot do, and I've been instructed very, very, very strictly on this, is the one thing we cannot do due to the fact of the Supreme Court decision, is it they have asked that there not really be any opinions in it as such, and possibly a comparison, which is a good idea, Kathy, in some general form. But we also don't want the brochure slanted toward the fact that we're really saying, well, you know, you really shouldn't have it,
really,
you don't really need it. We've got to be very, very careful with that.
Well, of course, this is standard information you get in a textbook, subjects covered and subjects in the Alaska Constitution are covered elsewhere. That's standard, so I think it would just be informative.
You know,
but I wanted to... I wanted to stress one thing. I'm involved in some other citizen activity, and we have to keep in mind the fact that most people watch television. That's where they get their news. And so you need to use the broadcast media, or you probably aren't going to have much of an impact as far as a mass citizen is concerned. So maybe little spots or talk shows, or I don't know how you can work that in your situation, or the radio. Helpful, I suppose.
Well, I was going to ask, y'all have great distances and isolations and
maybe have more time.
I don't know enough
to read
about the complexity of that, you know, but I'm sure you have a whole set of communication considerations that you have to bring to bear that are particularly unique to Alaska.
Actually, we have a fairly good system. We have our satellite system, which reaches all the Bush communities. They all have television now.
Is it quite 100%?
No, it's not 100, but it certainly covers quite a few of them. And of course, there's educational TV out there and that type of thing. It's ideal for that type of work. Plus, even our teleconferencing network from the legislative halls, which we can go out to 16 or 18 different places, and we can actually call a meeting in Juneau and have people in one of these locations, and they see us on television and we see them on television when they're talking back and forth to us. So we can have committee meetings in two different places in the state. I was smiling though on your comment, thinking about this morning when he was talking about newspapers, you know, versus television.
Yes.
but that is good. I think you're correct. I think the TV spots would also be a good way to do it, depending on how much. And I'm certain that different groups are going to be involved in this too. League of Women Voters and special interest groups that are going to, you know, have their say-so too about it. whether or not we should call it.
It'd really be tough to be the person to make up those spots.
Yes, it is.
You know, to have that short period of time and try to get enough information across.
And to make it interesting is, of course, a big problem.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This kind of material is kind of difficult to get to the mass public. Mm-hmm. But, of course, maybe you don't have to. Maybe it's just the elite public.
No, I don't think so. I think we would have to get to the mass public, and I it's kind of a challenge to me, possibly, to design some of these, too.
So. I know our people worked hard on it.
Yeah, if I had, you know, kind of thinking through what we've discussed thus far, if I could single out one thing that I would put more emphasis on than anything else, from where you are now to wherever you go, depending on the chain of events, is not only the complete appearance, but also the complete fact of integrity, of substance, of depth in your work, of statesmanship, all the way through. And whatever you know your political situations. But whatever you have to do to begin now to line up that kind of series of contributions by the various political leaders in a statesmanlike atmosphere.
That more than
anything else, I think, that, to me, would bear directly both on the outcome of your referendum and on if there is work beyond that with a commission and a convention and the ultimate quality and the outcome of that product. That single area is the one that, had I the opportunity to go back and do ours over, I would have wanted to spend much, much more time on developing that sense of, in the public's conception and eye, of just complete and total statesmanship and integrity, much as we used to revere the judiciary. I think we've come a ways on that and seen a little more human-like, but we used to think of the judiciary, the high bench and the ropes and the complete integrity, and I wish we had the chance again to work at that, and in our preparatory work, put as much time counseling with people.
It's been a tough road to hold.
Well,
I think the CRC probably put kind of statesmanlike, didn't it?
Yes.
But the legislature didn't.
You don't want the legislature serving as your convention.
More than anything else.
I promise you that.
My sense of where our whole process began to go downhill was when we lost the appearance of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not entirely sure that there still wasn't great statesmanship in those members of the legislature. There really was. Political careers that went down the drain over votes. Almost no one in the legislature I know of really gained from that process, politically or economically or any other way. But we lost the appearance of that, and it's downhill all the way to the vote. We tried to downhill to the end of the convention, and then there was the attempt through the legislature to bring the proposition back onto the ballot, and it still carried that taint to clear the point of the voting.
Well, as I say, though, keep in mind we had a tough road to hoe. We're going against ingrained prejudices of many years standing against the legislature.
And the governor who didn't support it.
Governor.
That was a critical factor, too.
Well, you don't have that problem, so. But you'll probably have the problem that so many states have, and that is to continue the momentum after the convention's over,
mm-hmm.
and to go right into the ratification campaign. But think of that right now.
Mm-hmm.
Think ratification right now in order to get it adopted.
Okay, in preparation then, we've talked about the citizen's guide, the annotation, the need for integrity, the commission itself. I'm just trying to review Texas's thing. I realize, okay, since it was a legislature, you basically would say it was a partisan delegates, because they...
Well, they were mostly Democrats. Right. I don't know whether it was a two-party contest, although the Republicans did. They didn't vote as a bloc, but there were a number of them that stuck together. And I think they were playing the game.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any feelings, any of you,
right
over the partisan versus nonpartisan election of delegates?
Well, I'd be very prejudiced myself towards a nonpartisan election of delegates.
Yeah, I think that's been proved to be better.
Yeah, that's fine. I mean, this is, you know, your idea, so whatever.
It's not
you...
our own experience.
Well, yeah, I was right. It's not our experience. I was just trying to think through your situation,
mm-hmm.
on that.
You might lose some of your most qualified people to serve on it if you had to have so many Republicans or so many Democrats, or if people had to run on a ticket or something.
I really think that starts to lay out the division early,
mm-hmm.
on.
Draw the lines,
draw
to step across.
Create the majority going in, form a more rigid.
You're trying to get it above politics, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Try
to make it a cohesive group,
a sort of a community kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. What, you know, one of the things that's been discussed kind of off and on with the various people that I've been meeting with is, what are your feelings toward, let's turn it down here so I'll bring it another way. Okay, what are your feelings toward the, we'll say, first of all, the site. We basically have our choice, and I realize you're not that familiar with Alaska. We basically have a choice between the University of Alaska, where it was held before, in Fairbanks. Imagine a larger community of Anchorage might possibly be looking for hosting it, since they would probably like to be near the majority of the people. We have the facilities and the rooms in Juneau, which is the state capital, or some other type of site. Do you have any feelings about whether it's good or bad to have it in the state capital because of the feelings possibly the public toward a state capital atmosphere or university atmosphere or anything of that type?
I'd say the university or possibly Anchorage. University is a little isolated, isn't it?
Well, it's not as much as it was in 1955. It would have the facilities because they're thinking of renovating Constitution Hall and using it for that particular purpose. We don't have to compete with the students because the people would be housed probably in Fairbanks as they were before. And you also don't necessarily need the amount of facilities that we have in Juneau, although that's very nice, and with the teleconferencing system and all, it makes it very convenient. But
I would have voted more for the campus city. The seat of government.
Well, if we're, you know, going to carry through this theme of civic community spirit, nonpartisanship, and then keep in mind this distrust of government, I think it's best to put it in the university. Don't beg trouble, in other words. If you have it in Alaska like you have other places, to get away from the captain.
But then do you give people the impression, having it in a university, and, you know, it succeeded before doing it in a university setting, but I think sometimes the rank and file citizen gets the feeling when things are done in a university setting as if that's some ivory tower kind of lofty concept that is somehow placing itself above the rest of the population or something like that. So you may have to balance that concept versus the distrust of government concept or
you have a clear
something
choice,
like that. Anguish.
Guy, I would thank you. I'm not meaning to dodge your question, but throw it back at you in a way that the key factor in my mind would be this public sense of neutrality.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know enough about Alaska to know which of those sites or others might meet that requirement best. I know that it would have been very difficult for us to hold a constitutional convention in Texas, in Houston, or in Dallas, because it would not have been perceived as neutral in terms of the economic interests.
Mm-hmm.
I think, Denise, it would have been very difficult to hold it on the University of Texas campus.
I think so too, with all of the university articles.
The university's ties into the constitutional funds, mm-hmm. and the feeling that it was. In fact, we had problems, if you recall, with our one public hearing on the University of Texas campus, and the regents, remember how the regents came down and blocked off all the seats in the front part of the hearing for themselves,
mm-hmm.
and there were people that were quite offended by that. It certainly was not a neutral feeling about our hearing on the university campus.
Of course, you do have the history. It was done.
Right.
You know.
And I say, I'm not arguing against
it. In Alaska, that might be the best
place.
In
that situation, that might well be the best place, but the neutrality criterion is the one that I would look for the most. Assuming
well,
you've got
your
location,
mm-hmm.
any of those would be
know.
Have certain transportation advantages.
Of course, the capital has the advantage of facilities.
Mm-hmm.
The printing shop. You have a printing shop. You have all that there.
The biggest advantage, and this is probably showing some personal bias, but the biggest advantage to me of staying away from the capital would be to simply change the usual order of business and doing things to make everybody involved.
Make
those
the lobbyists move.
Legislators that wanted to influence the process, the lobbyists that wanted to influence the process, to do it in a different environment, change the order of business and
not
play
to
the advantage that they have by they mean anybody that's well entrenched in the political environment of the capital city, the on home turf advantage that they have of established institutions, especially the lobbyists, in my opinion, from whatever side of the political spectrum.
Like access to information.
They're set up with
like
private
that.
Clubs and booths and newsletters and things where they can crank out and alert their members and all that. It's a lot easier for them to do it from the Capitol base if you're there in their home turf. This kind of thing ought to be a new order of business, not an old regular way of doing it.
You probably heard from Sam that they had their convention at Springfield, and a lot of the lobbyists didn't show up. In fact, they got kind of concerned no one was paying any attention to them. There was a legislative session going on also. That's where the lobby was.
Hmm. That was probably fortunate.
Well, that's... I think that's a... I agree lightly, but more seriously, I think that's a danger that you need to watch out for, and that is to try to have the organized groups really involved and really showing however you can do it to get them to show their cards what their real interests are, and somehow the discipline of the process forcing them up against making some early choices about what their real feelings are. We had a number of groups that laid back on our, during our preparatory commission's work. And didn't surface their real concerns during that process, and waited to surface many of the issues that really tore our convention apart. The right to work issue was compromised and kept silent. And not silent, I guess it means it was.
We didn't put it in anymore.
It was not publicly debated in any serious sort of a way. A number of other issues, specific groups that said very little about our changes and things that affected their interests, retired teachers and whatnot, until it hit the convention. So a lot of it, not a lot, a part, I guess, maybe, if I had to quantify it, maybe a fourth or less than that of the work, in my opinion, at least, of the revision commission was not real in terms of the real public debate that was going to go on in the convention. We had somehow sidestepped or...
The impact wasn't there at that stage.
Ignored or compromised quietly something that should have been more thoroughly debated, and with these interest groups drawn out so we could really find out what their position was.
I remember
that was too clear on through the vote. Some strong anti-legislature, anti-annual session kinds of concerns that were out there were never really fully brought to bear on the convention.
Well, we did have trouble with annual sessions. You remember that it was a long minority report. But I don't know, Alaska probably won't do what we did, which was really have a little mini convention before we had the main convention, because we had to do something about that Constitution to make it manageable. I mean, you don't have to do that, so you may even deny to your commission the power to make any recommendations. I don't know, some of the commissions don't have the power that ours could. They just write a few pamphlets and so forth, or do the mechanics.
Or write an annotation.
Or do the mechanics.
And then serve
as staff. The real arranging facility. But I do remember I was on a panel before, after the commission had completed its labors and before the convention met. And one of the panelists was a prominent beer lobbyist. He smirked at me and said, "Now we'll get it." Meaning, you know, yours was just the preliminary, but we know what to do in the convention. We'll just take care of it.
One of the things that the committee was considering doing, and I don't know how it's going to work in with our time frame this year, but prior to the, it had been planned on this year, and the committee didn't start. It was 3 months late in starting for various reasons. And one of the things that we had discussed doing was to hold public hearings throughout the state to, number one, acquaint people with, again, some of this public relation, the education that we're talking about, acquaint the people with some of the information that I found on this trip, information about the Constitution, about the convention, that type of thing, and in turn have them give us a feedback in what they feel, what their conception is of the Constitution, where what issues they feel should be looked at, and just a general feeling of what they have about, number one, the Constitution, number two, a constitutional convention. Do you think this is a good idea or not?
I would be positive about that sort of an activity. Again, I hearken back to my earlier comment about the decorum and the statesman-like way that certainly ought to be handled if it's going to be on the topic of the Constitution. But I think it'd be reasonable.
Well, you might uncover some things that way that you wouldn't know about otherwise. It might be that you don't want to hold the convention because you see some problems emerging. Or you might decide you should have the convention. If you follow me, there might be some, say, ultra-right or ultra-left types of proposals that you yourself or whoever from a political standpoint wouldn't like to see get out of hand, as it were. And this might be better than a public opinion poll. Just find out what the lay of the land is from a political standpoint.
Right. Of course, we have no choice.
That's what I was going to say. You don't have any
choice. We don't have a choice. The vote has to come before the people.
I know, but it might be that you'll be forewarned if nothing else. Or it might be used by people to have a no vote. In other words, there may be a side result, a spillover effect, that there's some things you don't expect might come out of this. But in a civic sense, it's always good to let people know what's going on and bring it up
and make the report.
In a neutral sense, whether I think there is a agree with Denise, but in a more neutral way, that there is a possibility that that the electorate and the leadership of the state might learn out of a hearing process some things that would help gel their the electorate's opinion or the leadership's opinion of what kind of a position they wanted to take, yes or no, on the vote. But, I guess I don't expect that the newness of your constitution and the shortness of it, the chances that process would alert some people that maybe they didn't want to have a convention, as Denise alluded to, is a bit more likely.
You're likely to get some things tacked on that you don't have now, is what I'm thinking about, especially if you have this unease. You know, you start, when you're in a time of trouble and crisis, you start getting out of under rocks. You're starting to get some irrational proposals that you might, I don't know whether this will happen or not, but I can foresee it.
It helps people and groups identify other and sometimes more appropriate avenues for expressing their concerns.
How's the tax situation there? You have a bonanza, don't you, in terms of you're giving money
giving
back?
Money away.
Well, you probably won't have that problem.
Following along with that a little bit, another thought had occurred, that the possibility as a follow-up to these hearings, suppose that there was a set, and I'm going to pick a number out of the air, four major things that turn up at this public hearing that the people seem to be very concerned with that the legislature hasn't addressed. Some of the work that I did last year, I identified every constitutional amendment that's ever been proposed by the legislature since statehood, which was an interesting chore. But anyway, what happened to it, you know, where it went, how many committees it passed, or whether it died or whatever. One of the suggestions was that suppose we had turned up four or five things that seemed to be, in most of the hearings that we held, there was a consensus that maybe those should be changed and the legislature hasn't addressed them. The other possibility was that at the same time the vote for whether or not to have a constitutional convention was up, would be that these amendments would appear on the ballot also, passed by two-thirds of the legislature and placed before the voters at the same time. What are your feelings about that?
We'll defer to Denise a minute on that. That's her field, really. She's studied our amending process more than any other single person.
Well, let me get that straight. You have in mind putting on some amendments at the same time as the yes or no? Well, in our experience, I do find that the voters do discriminate in terms of if you're thinking in terms of passage or defeat of these adjacent amendments, or if you're thinking of the lightning rod type of thing. In other words, are you saying to the voters in so many words, here are some controversial issues. You can decide them now. You don't have to have a convention to do it. If you're thinking along those lines, that would be probably a good strategy to do that. If you're thinking along the lines of just approval or disapproval of those amendments, sometimes there's a feeling that if this vote is affirmative for the convention, all these others will pass just because it's on the same ballot. In other words, people will vote for all of them pretty much as a package. Or the reverse might hold. I guess that's what Jim had in mind from my research. But our research has been in connection with the convention, primarily whether to tack on amendments when you're voting up or down the Constitution, and that's another situation. And I think, generally speaking, it's discovered that it is wise to separate out from the proposed Constitution some of your most controversial issues so that they can be decided on their own merits and the whole thing is pulled down. So I think it's a different situation here when you put them on the same ballot as a yes or no. From a civic standpoint, I think that should be by itself, whether you want a convention or not. I don't think it should be associated with anything else.
Well, basically, we're talking about just the same ballot. Because, in other words, we only have one more chance to place amendments before the people, before the question. I mean, it has to be the same time. We only put amendments on the ballot. Well, normally we only put amendments on the ballot on your general election years. Okay. At your general election.
Well, it's going to be on the ballot with the yes or convention.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That has to be on there, right?
All right. Well, there are just two ways of looking at it. One is if you your strategy is to kind of discourage a vote, you might say to voters, as I suggested, here are some things that have come out of our hearings, and here's your chance. You can vote them up or down now. You don't have to have a convention for it. Or you can leave them off on the assumption that this is premature. If you're going to have a convention, then that's the sort of thing you ought to discuss when you get to the convention. So I guess it's up to your strategy. There is no yes or no here. It's what you're trying to do.
It could help you to have it. Go ahead, Jim.
It's a matter of strategy, yes.
I think it might help you to have those three or four issues on the ballot with the yes or no, because then if you end up with another convention, you would at least know what the most current reading of the people was on those issues. If you didn't have a convention, well, then you might have pleased the people with their opportunity to vote on those issues, and, you know, whether they passed and were added to the Constitution or didn't pass and weren't added to it, you might have achieved a little bit more satisfaction in the electorate by having them on there.
I kind of harken back to Denise's comment about the public concern over their ability to trust government. And my answer to you on that one would be that there very well may be some item or items that on their own merit and in the best interest of Alaska needs to be on that ballot at that time as an amendment, but that I would not contrive to put issues on there because I think the public distrust is such that it would be seen as a strategy, if you will, to in some way, one way or the other, influence that vote on the convention. And so as a strategy, in the sense of we were talking about a minute ago, I would not do it. If there's a sound, independent, fundamental reason to have something up there, a debt ceiling or some particular issue that really must, no convention vote or no convention vote would have needed to be on the ballot that year at that time, well, fine. But I certainly wouldn't argue for a strategy of putting things on there to some way affect or impact. I think that vote on the convention ought to be a clean vote up or down.
Okay, that's let's go ahead and assume now that we've had the vote and we're going to have a convention. Okay, now, of course we talked about the preparatory commission. I suppose really, Jim, with your background, things that you were involved with in this type of thing, that I might ask you, where do we go from here?
So you're at that point then back in the legislative arena, right, in terms of enabling statute, are we, or are we assuming we've already got an
enabling legislation? I'm going to assume that our enabling legislation is going to pass this coming legislative session. At least, if not this one, in 81, possibly in 82, which would be prior to the election. I think we'll get enabling legislation done before. We have two legislative sessions to get it done in before there's an actual vote on the Constitutional Convention. I think the feeling of the legislators on this committee is to at least get that done, get that over with, so that the people know how their delegates are going to be chosen, and they know exactly what to expect if they do vote for having a Constitutional Convention. That's one of the reasons I'm getting it out in the front. And so
I agree with that approach. But would the preparatory, would the enabling legislation, would that spell out whether there was a preparatory commission and what powers it had and what size it had and how it was appointed and so forth and so on? So that's all, once the election takes place, we assume that's all behind us.
Right.
But, you know, we're just looking at preparing for the convention itself.
Right.
The polishing and finishing and the further development of the information research area, the beginnings of the budgetary and physical and physical preparations, the planning for the briefing and orientation and the care and feeding and all of the delegates, where you're at that point. We found that the orientation kinds of sessions we had where we brought in not only our best minds from our state, but enrich that greatly with people from all over the country to be extremely useful, both prior, in our case, both prior to the commission, the preparatory commission, and then prior to the convention.
Well, we got a seminar.
Yeah, so you brought in people from outside, both orientation for the preparatory commission and also orientation for the delegates after the election.
I was in charge of what we called the seminar, wasn't it? The vice chair wanted to have a seminar.
Mm-hmm.
So I consulted with everybody, and we had John Devout and George Breeden and Terrell Blodgett and Frank Elliott. We had a committee to try to pull everything together, and I think it was, we had a day and an evening, I believe, was ours.
Now this was for the commission?
Then we also had, kind of think, the delegates, and they brought in the press. That was a separate one, or was that connection with the press? We had a press one. Oh, and then we had one for the delegates, too. So we had several preparatory sessions.
We set an early part of the convention aside for the committee by committee expert testimony and briefing from our preparatory commission to the delegates.
I see.
And I thought that was very useful.
Well, you remember we had this, we had the one for the press, and we had other conventions represented, and they dealt with how they got the message out to the people. But was it the day after we had the delegates there, that is the representatives and senators, and we spoke, remember, it was over in Joe C. Thompson. This was before the convention met. And I can't remember, was it a 1 or 2 day session? Was it all involved in one?
A day long.
Were these two together, the media and the delegates? I can't remember. It seems like they were...
I'm a little fuzzy on that too, Janice.
But I know we had one just for media. That's what it was for. And it was in the Joe C. Thompson. Then I remember very clearly we had all the representatives and senators there at Joe C. Thompson. So that must have been the next day or something. We couldn't.
It was
Then we also had the
Before January.
They had the National Municipal League Convention in Dallas. And we had some things there, and four our representatives and senators, and then the members of the CRC went around to different communities, and one of the functions was to meet with the incoming representatives and senators, and we had small meetings with them and exchanged ideas. So there was a definite effort to get these people ready for the convention. Now, I don't know that your commission, you know, would do that.
I can't overemphasize the value that the National Municipal League was to us in that part of the process, the orientation kinds of things. We knew pretty well who our president of the convention was going to be, and who some of the main actors were going to be in advance, as I suspect you, particularly if you have this large vote, you may know. And we set up the National Municipal League meetings in Dallas. We set up our president to be of the convention and our lieutenant governor in a room in the hotel, and two of the good offices, the league, and individual people like John Bebout and Sam Dove. We ran as many former convention presidents as we could through that room to talk and compare. We ran former staff directors, university people like Sam Gove, through, and gave our core leadership there some exposure to those who had trod the path before them. It was very, very, very helpful, I thought.
During the convention, you called in people like Sam Gold, too.
For the expert witness testimony.
Yeah, an expert witness to decide when we should set the election, you know, just what the ballot should look like. You remember, we called in those people.
And that, I know what my transition was I was going to make, but in this period of time we're talking about now, after your vote and before you meet, the matter of beginning on the rules. And I'm sure,
that's my next question.
Sure, from the others that you've talked to, you've gotten a big dose of that. But this orientation process we're talking about was very helpful in that, and that our leadership to be could ask them very specific questions. How did this kind of rule work out, and how did that kind of rule work out? And should you have how should you handle the voting? We had a peculiar problem, a required two-thirds vote. Whether to take it two-thirds all the time or take it from the end, which we rolled the dice on.
We never got two-thirds on the end, except for the
There was no...